We are doing an oral history interview on this day, October 20th, 2014. My name is Cyril Jefferson. The other interviewer is Savannah Sowers, and we are interviewing Miss Mary Lou Blakeney. The time now is 5:04, and this interview is for the William Penn High School project. Miss Blakeney, how are you doing?
Doing great, thank you.
Okay. I guess we'll just jump right in it, and I'll ask you, if you could, in a sentence, statement, or whatever, maybe generalize your feelings and memories of William Penn and your time here.
And you want me to do that in a sentence?
Well, let's say there was a main word to give, and then we'll start to dive into some of those specific memories and those specific details.
I'm not even sure one word would do it, but mm-hmm. when people say you went to William Penn, mm-hmm. or oh, so you just went to William Penn, I went, I don't know how you mean that. And oftentimes people that don't know the school and its rich history say that, and I said, what you don't understand is going to William Penn was not just going to school, it was an experience. It was a well-rounded experience. At William Penn, you were not taught just the academics. You were taught the social graces. You were taught the arts, the culture, music. You had so many facets to being a student at William Penn. And so that's why I say it was an experience. That's, if I had to give you one word, that's the one thing I think would cover all of that. But now I'd have to embellish on the experience, and we don't have enough time.
Well, let's see if we can dive a tad bit into some of those experiences. Do you have any favorite classes, favorite teachers maybe, that you remember, favorite after-school activity, extracurricular? You mentioned arts. Were you in the band maybe? What's some of those specific things that add to that experience, and what are some of those favorite things?
Well, first of all, we didn't have middle school, so I came to William Penn in the seventh grade. Seventh and eighth grades were behind the auditorium and the upper left side of the second floor, because they did not let us intermingle with the high school population. And in the seventh grade, I was exposed to more music because Miss Brown and Miss Jones were good friends, and she would come in and teach classes in music to us in seventh grade. So somehow I got to be the person who was the leader for the music class, and I thought, I don't know how that happened, but when I got exposed to the zither and more of the violin families, like the viola and all of that, because Miss Brown would bring these instruments to show us, and then she would play them. I couldn't play them. We knew the piano, of course, and then there was a recorder and some other things that she had, and she loved coming in to explore with our class. And that did not generate my interest in band, but yeah, I became a band member in the seventh grade. J.Y. Bell came to William Penn that year.
Right.
I was in his first band. And he would later become sort of like a surrogate play father, mm-hmm. he and his wife. His wife taught me in eighth grade, and he had me from 7 through 12. So I played B-flat clarinet for him. And the last year, he let me be a majorette. I'd asked 2 years before, and he said, I can't do that. I said, why? He said, because you got the straightest line in the band, and everybody shoots for you. They can't get you, but they can shoot for you. And he was right. I did have. But we would go out and practice on the tennis courts down the hill here, and we'd make up dances to popular tunes like Last Night, but you don't remember those. You're too young. The Barcades. Dun 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 dun. We made dance steps to that, and so when we performed in parades, we stopped and did our dances and stuff, and we got known for that. And I was one of the two that co-led that dance piece. We'd go by the 45 record. You have no clue what I'm talking about, do you? The 45 record, and Mr. Bell would write it for the band. He was a Michigan-trained person, so he knew. He was absolutely awesome. And so during that time, too, though, I was a cheerleader for 4 years in high school. I did plays from 7th grade, 8th grade up. I did oratorical speaking, a little bit of everything. I enjoyed my school years here. That blue and white, I bled. I supported the school in every way I possibly could, including selling Mr. Goodbars and stockings and meals to raise money for band uniforms. We didn't have decent band uniforms, but everybody knew who we were because we could play and we could dance, and we were in lots of competitions. So everybody's idea of raising money was to help sell stuff. And we did. I didn't get to wear the new uniform. My brother did later when he came to William Penn, but with everything from the spats to the different hats and all the braids and everything. But that's okay. We were right. We said we were ragged, but we were right. And we got invited to ANC, Winston-Salem. I think we went to North Carolina Central for one of their homecoming things, too. We're in the Christmas parade here. And our band would march from this campus over to High Point U. We didn't have a stadium. And we would march, and then sometimes we'd have a bus, but not always, because we didn't have the money. And it was hard getting the money from downtown, so we did what we had to do that. But those were some good years. They taught us a lot about tenacity, and about goal setting.
Right.
About just being and helping each other. Because it wasn't about you rising and everybody else staying down here. As you rose, you reached down and grabbed somebody's hand and pulled them up too. So it was like a brotherhood or a fraternity or a sorority like none other, being in Bell's band. No football team, none of the other clubs or anything could compare with what Bell's band meant to us. And you could ask any one of his students, and they tell you the same thing pretty much. First of all, Mr. Bell was not just a band teacher. That's why he was my very favorite, probably of all. Mr. Bell would be a confidant, father figure, mother figure. He would see your report card before your parents did, and he would come to your house and talk to your parents about your behavior, good, bad, or otherwise. He was more encouraging, and if you picked a school and he knew the reputation of that school was not what was going to be best for you because he had you all this time and watched you grow, he was there. You didn't have to go to his office. He'd come to your house.
So Bell, he obviously, I know myself, I've learned of the impact that he's had on bands here. I myself being a former student of Andrew's band, and I now teach there. So I've heard some about Bell, but it seems that sometimes he can be forgotten. What do you think is the legacy of Bell, and what is it necessarily, if you want to go into some specific type of things that he may have done, that can really, for you, carve out his legacy?
Unlike many teachers, and some of them probably did, but Bell cared. Bell cared about every part of your life. If you happen to be living in a neighborhood that was not the best, not the safest, that maybe you had to light by kerosene lamp sometimes to try to get your homework done, he could empathize. Sympathize too. He had some parts of his life that were not the greatest, even though it was University of Michigan where he ended up. And he would forgive some things and give you time to come to his office and do some things if you needed to. Or you can come down and do homework, you know, something. I'm going to come over to the campus early or what have you. If you needed clothing, he brought some of his own clothing. If you needed money for lunch, he provided that sometimes. If you needed money for maybe bus fare and you had gotten a job or something and for some reason you were late in class and you needed to get to work on time. He has taken kids in his car. Bell was the total package. The total package. And what you said to Bell stayed with Bell. That's important for all teachers to know. So don't forget that when they talk to you. They talk to you oftentimes from their heart. If they believe they can trust you, and we believe we could trust him. And sure, there were those that didn't particularly care for him because he wanted order. If he said, I'm teaching about this and these kind of notes, and oh, being in Bell's band didn't mean that you stayed in the same situation the whole time. You could be first chair clarinet, but you had to compete for that first chair. So he'd say, okay, today competition. All right, I want you, challenge you. And that's what he did, because he made sure everybody in there could play. And he'd call you out. Okay, you, take it from the top. You, take it from the middle, or the third, whatever. And if you couldn't do it, he'd work with you to try to get you better. And if you just could not do it, then he'd say, well, you know, you may not be able to do this with the marching band, but maybe with the concert band, because he had both. And we had the spring concerts. And, you know, as well as the band competitions off campus, on the campuses of colleges and universities. Well, colleges then, all colleges, including A&T. And he just made sure that you knew what you were doing. And I think he tried harder, too, because we didn't have the look that a lot of the bands had. We didn't have enough uniforms for everybody, even. And even some of those had to be mended, and, you know, they were a little bit tattered, but, you know, we didn't care. We could play, and we knew what we were playing, and we had enough trophies and things to let you know that we knew what we were doing. And it was all under his tutelage. And then especially when we learned the 101 steps a minute that Tennessee State was doing, oh, yeah, he always brought new things into us, or we could take it to him. He listened. He heard us, but he listened to us, and that's key. Many people can't do but one of them, and it's usually not the listening part. They hear you, but they really don't listen to you. And because we were younger, didn't mean that much. He treated us like we were his equal when we were talking. And he made us think. He provoked us, motivated us. And he was just there. You could break up with your girlfriend. You could go to Bell and talk to him about it. He always tried to put some salve on the sore. Just tried to soothe whatever the pain was you were feeling. If things were going wrong in your home, with your parents, what have you. If court, he's gone to court with kids that may have been wrongly accused of something. And or if they asked him, they may have been rightly accused. But he could go and it seemed to soften the situation because he was there and he could still give a hug. Then we'll be waiting for you. You know, we'll see what happens here. And he would, if it was somebody doing the right thing, he'd write that letter. I'm not trying to make him a saint. But God, he was a good man. He was a good man. Every student should have a Mr. Bell in their lives. Every student. Or Mrs. Bell, as it were.
In their lives. You want to tell us some about Mrs. Bell?
Mrs. Bell was also a music person. That was his focus. It was her focus. And she was a Bennett grad. And she was from Reeseville, North Carolina. And he was from Selma, North Carolina. And they had the one daughter, Cookie. And her name was Janine. He was J.Y., Jasper Young Bell. Cookie's name was Janine Yvette, his initial Bell. And we called her Cookie. And they located in Greensboro after Cookie was born. She was three when they built a house on Tuscaloosa Street. And then she moved over and started teaching at Bluford. But she was here teaching eighth grade while I was here for those first 3 years, I think, and then after she had Cookie, they built a house and moved up because they were renting here from a lady on Underhill Street. Mm-hmm. That's what a lot of teachers did, that, like Mr. Lawrence, who taught civics, lived in Durham, but he would come up and rent a room and then go back on Fridays and come up on Monday mornings, that kind of thing. He had several teachers that did that kind of thing. But Mrs. Bell played piano. That was what she, and she sang, a beautiful voice. But she wanted to work with me with the piano. I don't know. My mom had tried a year and a half before then, but I wouldn't practice. I wanted to be outside with my cousin, and we didn't have a piano, but my cousin did. So we'd take lessons, you know, an hour here and back to back. And then we'd go to her house. Well, by that time, we were tired. We didn't want to play piano anymore. And she lived there, so she could do it anytime. And I wouldn't do it. So my mom said, okay, well, I'm done. You know, you're not going to stay with this, so I'm going to, you know, leave that alone. But then I picked up a little bit more from Mrs. Bell when I'd be over at the house on weekends. You know, we just, I'd mess around with it, and then she'd come sit down, and we'd start doing, she'd do some instruction. But they had lots of musical folk coming into the house, so I got exposed to the Greensboro band directors, some Winston-Salem band directors, and stuff that would come see them. And it was just amazing. Mr. Bell played trombone. That was his horn. He played with a jazz quintet in Greensboro, and they played lots of different venues. And there's a picture of him in the Omega House, I think it was, where I attended some event, and he was on the wall there. And it was since his demise. But I felt like I lost my father when he passed. That's how bad that was. I was married, living in Santa Barbara, California. He had seen my husband and my children because every time I came home, I had to go see Bill. I had my dad really kind of resented my closeness to Mr. Bell, but he would listen to me, you know. I could talk to him. And my dad was one of these, you do as I say, not as, you know. But it was a good mix. It was a good mix. But Cookie grew up. She went to UNC Chapel Hill, and music was in her blood, too. She had her own radio show in high school, and she has a dance troupe that has traveled internationally. She lives in Richmond, and it's called the Elegba Society, and her daughter danced with her for several years, and now the daughter has a daughter. She's married and has a daughter, so I don't know if she's still dancing. I haven't seen her since her mother passed, but her business was downtown, and she brought the Kwanzaa, the first Kwanzaa celebration to Richmond. Cookie did. So, you know, I just stayed in touch with her through her mother a lot, and then I took her mother up a couple of times for different occasions. We did do the Kwanzaa piece with her one time, right after I think it was the second one that she did for the city. And I don't know that it's still continuing because I have lost track of her. She's still in Richmond, that's all I know, and that she's a grandmother now. But both the Bells are dead. Mr. and Mrs. Bell are dead, so... you know, it's amazing, but I have since met a grandson who's a minister and has a church in Durham.
A grandson of J.Y. Bell?
Uh-huh.
Wow.
I knew J.Y. had an older child, but I didn't remember if it was a female or a male, but it's a daughter. And she had a son, or has a son, and he is in the mom's name, but I met him at the Church of God and Prophecy on Stanton Place about 3-4 years ago. And he does say that he is I say, you need to come back in this community more. Your daddy has left a legacy over here. I mean, your granddaddy. And people need to know you. They need to know you and feel you. Because that man has been revered in this city for years and years. I don't think it's died. I really don't. And not as long as one of his band students is alive, they won't die. I really don't think so. Because I think he's been fair, totally fair. And I don't know that you'd find anybody that could say otherwise about him. And like I said, there were those that may not like him. He did break up a couple of relationships because he knew this guy was not for this girl. And if he saw this, he would try to dissuade the thing from happening, and he could see that, okay, this guy does not treat girls really well. You don't need to be a part of that. And he would say it in front of the guy. And that's why they didn't like him. Eventually, I think they got over it, but still, he would say it. He would say it like he meant it. And you just couldn't argue with that.
Right.
So, but he just wanted the best for everybody. He knew that everybody could rise above their means, meager though they could be, or less than meager. And many of them were, many of them back then. I mean, you think about the economy now. It was really rough, you know, coming up. But everybody was pretty much in the same boat, and you could still be happy and still get along. And that village that Hillary Clinton talks about, we had that. We did have that. And it's unfortunate we don't have it today. But neighbors could raise other neighbors' kids in that if they were latchkey kids, they would watch out for them, let no harm come to them, feed them if necessary, share clothing, share food, share transportation, whatever the needs, or money, whatever. And let one kid from the neighborhood go off to college. Everybody came with something to go in the coffers or to go in the suitcase. I remember when I went to nursing school, I had stockings and boxes of cookies and all kinds of stuff brought to me. And things had gotten better at that time, but still. And you didn't forget that kind of thing. You sent a thank you letter. You sent a thank you letter from school to let them know how much you appreciated that. And they'd send you a note just encouraging you. That was a wonderful thing back then. And so on your trips home, you made sure you went by to say hi and give them a hug and let them know how well you were doing, or, you know, whatever. Those kinds of things don't happen that much anymore. That's unfortunate.
When I listen and I'm hearing the account of Mr. Bell, and it seems like at that time played the role of someone who could instill hope.
Oh, yes.
And from what's commonly told about that time period, that was a very troubling time, obviously, for oppression and racism and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you say that he was that figure who could be surrogate, and you talk about the community and the village that you all had, how do those things impact you all? Or how did that impact you all in response to what was happening at that time, I guess? What was happening at that time politically, what was happening at that time socially, and what was happening at that time, I guess, legally? What's the impact, and what's some of the direct correlation or effect?
Well, Bell knew when we got started, but I went to him and told him that I was going to be participating. He never once said don't. He said, you've thought it through? I said, yes. You know what to expect? No. You know what could happen? Yes, we have some idea. But you're going to do it anyhow, aren't you? Yes. Be careful. Watch your back. Watch your partner's back, because we knew that we were going to be, you know, looking out for each other, both sides, and the guys were going to be ringing us when we were marching. And he said, don't do anything foolish. You know, try to do what you can to stay within the law while you do it. But he was encouraging that way, as was Burford. Burford was threatened by the superintendent, because he wanted him to stop us. And when we found out about it, our statement to them was, it's after school. He doesn't have anything to do with us after school. Our parents said it's okay. So my mother did. My dad said, you're going to make me have to go to jail. And I didn't understand that. I said, but Daddy, you're not marching. He said, yeah, but somebody's going to do something to you, and I'm going to have to hurt them, and I'm going to have to end up in jail. Well, I wasn't even thinking about that part. I just kept praying that the parents were not going to allow things to happen to us, the black parents and the white parents. And we lucked out the first few years anyhow, because we never went to jail.
Now, what you're mentioning and what you're referencing, obviously, I know because you've talked to me before mm-hmm. about the sit-in. But for the sake of the record and also for the sake of my fellow interviewer, do you mind going into a little more detail to what you're talking about when you say the conversation between you and Mr. Bell said, do you know what you're doing? What exactly are you referencing?
I'm referencing the beginning of the sit-in because being one of the four students who organized it, I shared with him what we were planning to do, actually before we did it. I knew I could talk to him. I mean, I talked to my mom. She knew. I talked to Mr. Bell. He knew. And I could tell them anything, and I knew it would stay with them. You know, the idea was for this to be a surprise attack. When we went downtown, we weren't supposed to be expected, but we found out later there was a leak. But it didn't get to spread too wide. But one or two people had an idea. You know, they just didn't know what time. They didn't have the time. And so when I talked to him about that, he knew the injustices. He'd suffered them too. He was a black man, after all. And it just seemed to be at that time anybody of color could be a target at any given time for any given reason or no reason and anywhere. That still happens in some places. And so he knew how hard it was going to be. He knew what the ultimate sacrifices could have to be. We didn't have the billy clubs or the dogs and that kind of thing right then like they did in Deeper South. And not only Deeper South, Virginia and North too. More prevalent in the Deep South, so people think it never happened above the Mason-Dixon line. That's not true. That is definitely not true. And he was just warning us, and he's one of the first people that I know tried to beat into us. It is important what you look like and how you act.
Why so?
Because if you, as a young black boy, went downtown bagging and sagging, okay, maybe a hoodie, okay, I didn't say it was right, but look at the Trayvon Martin, mm-hmm. the brown kid, and others since there between those two deaths, because he had a hoodie on, the suspicion is that you're up to no good. And why? Maybe one person they saw dressed like you did it, so now you're all labeled. And that's why he's saying it is what you look like. It is how you act. If you're loud and rowdy, playing around, that kind of thing, many times, and they watch the movies too, there's a weapon somewhere. You may have intentions of distracting somebody to rob, that kind of thing. That was still going on then. Not nearly as common as it is now. Because our neighborhood was self-sustained except for maybe probably fresh meat. Big Bear was the market up on Montlu at that time. So now where the across from the library, that little strip mall behind Walgreens, right there. It was right there. That was a Big Bear. And for fresh meat, you had some neighborhood stores, and they would have limited amounts, you know, but we'd go out of there for that. But Washington Street had everything we wanted, pretty much. You had your grills, your restaurants, your hair salons, your barbershops. You had doctors and dentists. You had attorneys. You had churches. You had a men's clothing store. You had seamstresses. You had an oil company. You had a shoe shop. we had pretty much what we needed. And then right on 4th Street, we had Hazel Funeral Home. Down the street, well, on Washington Street next to the, oh, we had drugstores too. You had Moore's Funeral Home. Further down, you had Hoover's Funeral Home. There were five doctors, medical doctors. You had three dentists. At one time, there were three drugstores. Only one dental office is still there, and that's Carl Little running his daddy's, Perry Little's office now. But it was a whole street of teeming things. You had a pool room.
Any banks?
No banks.
No banks.
No banks. The YMCA and YW, they were kind of together again, were up over Jackie's place in that same building. And later they would teach GED classes up there because my mother went. I'd walk up with her sometimes in the evening to just to go up there for her to do that when I was in high school. But they had a fish market. I mean, you had pretty much what you needed. And then you come down, and there's William Penn. Well, that was the focus of most of our life. That and Washington Terrace Park, you know, that was our social outlet, the park. And at the school, when we had a lot of night things going on. Plays and concerts, games, all over the place. I mean, we had a good full life. But there were still barriers. At the end of College Drive, which was Harrison Street, and I lived on Harrison Street in Graves, right on the corner, we skated. They've changed the configuration of the street now because it was like a sloping curve. And we used to roller skate down that street. And at the end of that street, there was a barrier. You couldn't go out across Montlu at one point. And I said, you know, how things change, how things can change. But you had the houses that came back this way, and they were sort of like separate, definitely not equal. But if you learn to tolerate some things, put up with some things, and that's the way it's been. And I make no apology for it. We did it. We grew up born into it, didn't know any better, but parents protected you as best they could, i.e., before I came to High Point, I lived in Lumberton, North Carolina, and my mother would say, get a drink of water before we go downtown and go to the bathroom, because we were not going to use the colored bathrooms. Or the drink from the colored fountain. She was determined that wasn't going to happen. But we could not try on clothing when we went to make purchases. Not then, not here. Even my Girl Scout uniform at Belk, one of my favorite stores, but couldn't do it then. And movie theater. You're sitting up over somebody's head. That's stupid to me, but that's where they put us. And, of course, you know, people would get angry about situations. I mean, why don't we have to come up the stairs? Why can't we sit downstairs? And they would throw boxes down and popcorn and drinks and all kinds of stuff. So there were fights sometimes at the bottom of the stairs when we came out. But that retaliation didn't last that long. Somebody usually got arrested. And you go back in the community and tell whoever their lawyer is at the time, because you did have attorneys. Chess was on that street, who would later become the first circuit judge in the 20th century for North Carolina. And there was another. Oh, Langford had an office on Washington Street, too, for a time. But he was not as well known or as popular as Chess. But they would go get him out. They'd bail him out. The community would rally and pay for that. They'd get him out of jail. I mean, that village was strong. It was. There were issues, but usually somebody could talk to somebody who was going afoul of the law to try to get him to stop. It wasn't that often that you found one you couldn't reach. So when I talked to Bell about these things, knowing that what could happen or having some idea, Jet was a good history book for us.
Jet the magazine?
Jet the magazine.
Oh, wow.
It's about like so, but it had so much black news from so many different areas, and so much of it was about the atrocities, like Emmett Till. Okay. We got a lot of that news in there. Ebony, too, was more focused that way.
Emmett Till happened in the 40s or 50s, somewhere around that time. I don't want to be wrong. History major might get wrong.
It was 50s. I'm thinking late 50s. I should remember that, but I don't now. I finished in 62, so I'm thinking it was late 50s.
So you were in
high
school?
Which would have made me about 15, somewhere around there, I think.
About high school?
I think I was about 14, maybe 15, between 13 and 15, I believe, when that happened, Or 13 and 16, when that happened.
As you bring up Emmett Till, I'm curious to know just the kind of impact it had on you all, even though it wasn't the same community. I know things happen now, like you mentioned, the Michael Brown incident, and now we have conversations all the way here in High Point, North Carolina, in regards to what happened. What kind of conversations were you all having? What are some of the, results? How were people taking it?
People were very angry. Very, very angry. And it didn't take much of anything to spark a negative. If somebody happened to walk by you on the street and brush your shoulder after that had just happened, you might have a black man turn around and in a threatening way maybe said, why don't you look where you're going? And then if they said something ugly, that could create a situation. And 9 times out of 10, a black man was going to lose. Because here would come the Billy Clubs. Couldn't be a one-on-one situation. But the people were very angry, very angry. And whenever they saw a car in the neighborhood, which didn't happen that often, they might throw rocks at it, smash the windows, whatever. They responded in whatever way they could, and that was limited, okay? Because they knew what the recourse would be, and that was the sad part. They were not allowed to show their anger. There was no way to get rid of that aggression except to turn it inside. And sometimes I still feel that that had a lot to do with some of the domestic violence. Mm-hmm. You can't attack your enemy, who is in fact the white man. And so you're about to spill over, and then somebody says one thing wrong, and the next thing you lash out, and you smack somebody. Not excusing it, but the control wasn't there. And I still feel that that may have been the start of some things. I feel very strongly that was. Unfortunately, sometimes today it still happens. But I don't know why you can't go out there and pitch some rocks in the creek or go bowling. It's my thinking. If everybody did that, think where we'd be. My God. But it's happening too much, and those numbers are going up again. Now it's teen domestic violence. Shouldn't be going on. I don't remember too much of that going on when we were in school. There were a couple of guys I knew used to smack the girls, and I remember seeing something once, and the guy threatened to smack me and have to bring it. Mm. I mean, that wasn't going to happen. But she would cower, when he would come around, and he said, "Why are you talking to him? Silly stuff. You guys should be living your lives. These are the best years of your life. And you won't realize it until you're probably 25 years old. These are formidable years and formative years. And it's up to you. But to have somebody dictate to you who you can talk to, who you can walk with in the hallway, or what have you, and it's not your parent? No, that should never be. And anybody that would do that to you now will do worse to you later, if you don't know that. But it's rampant now. And I don't understand what, where the girls' heads are. But you see it, you know. I didn't understand it when the married couples, well, I certainly don't understand it with the kids. I just don't. These are supposed to be learned people. You're here getting an education, and you don't know that somebody that can physically assault you has no right to do that, and then you're not going to tell somebody? Oh, no, you tell and tell and tell. And you learn how to defend yourself. That's what you do. And you get away from that person as fast as you can and stay away. That's not love. Love shouldn't hurt. And real love doesn't hurt. So, you can't get that through the girls' heads yet. We'll keep trying. We'll continue to try. But those were really, really hard times, trying times. And you just tried not to get caught out at night by yourself. In your neighborhood, fine. Washington Street, you know, across the railroad track, Hoskins over that way and stuff. All the black neighborhoods, I felt safe in. I would have no reason to be walking up by Emory Wood or, you know, the south side over that side. That's, well, you had whites and blacks living kind of there together. And certain, well, it was like a border. You have the white ones here and the black ones down here, but still, they interacted sometimes. Because I think Doc Kern tells me that her, either her family's property, or her family's property backed up to Mary Walker's property, who was a black lady, friend of ours. In fact, I think Fairview School, I think, got the land to build that school from the Walker family. Yeah. So that's, yeah, so there was a fence, you know, that was that separated our properties. But she said, I remember that. They were, she was a Gray at the time. Her maiden name was Gray. But she later married a Walker. And I didn't know that piece until Dot told me. And she knows a lot about the South Side history. But looking at all of these things, you wonder how sometimes some of us got out and some of us didn't. I'm glad I was one that got out. But, and I had no intentions of coming back to High Point to live. None. Never wanted to come back. It had not been the best thing to happen to me, in that the segregation piece was just so ugly. And yet it wasn't as ugly as it was many, many places. That was horrific, a lot of places. But it was just heavy. It was too much. And so when I went to Atlanta, I thought somebody had opened a prison door. The blacks had so much control there in every way, every facet of their lives. They owned things. They lived well. They were educated well. The transportation system was fine. You had job security. Everything you could want. Atlanta was wide open for the black person in 1962 when I went there, and had been before then. So it was already created. It wasn't just going. Charlotte, I likened to Atlanta when I went in 1962. Charlotte 5 to 6 years ago, when it started to spreading, just like tentacles in every direction. Atlanta was still doing that, and it was already a city of a million when I went there. And so now it's all over that place. And I think Charlotte's going to take over. I'm here to be touching High Point before long, because all of your major business and corporations are coming into there. Like it came, I watched it come into Atlanta. All the professional teams came while I was there, except the hockey team. What with the Braves and the Falcons and
Hawks.
Yeah, because Lou Hudson was one of them, and I knew him when he was at Dudley. He was a year ahead of me, but I knew him when he came down, and then Curly Neal. And it's just amazing the things that I saw and wanted better for here, but didn't want to be the one to have to bring it here. Didn't want to, you know, didn't want to do that again.
You mentioned Mr. Burford, Samuel Burford,
yeah,
earlier. And as I'm looking, we're in the alumni room, and I see a lot of plaques and awards and diplomas and certificates. And Sam Burford's name is on a majority of them. Do you mind to talk about him just a bit?
Oh, I'd love to talk about Mr. Burford. I loved him.
Who was the principal?
He was the principal. He was the man from Virginia. I think it was Lynchburg, his home. And he was schooled, college in Virginia. But he came here from, another little place first. I can't remember now, this very minute, where. But he came in here, and he was the man. That front door we walked in, he would stand there every morning. There's a picture, picture of him standing at the end of the hall looking out. That's not the one. He would be at this door before that last bell rang every morning if he happened to be in town, and most times he was. And the door, he would stand right there. And you walked in, and the door, he said, okay, little girl, go to my office. Okay, young man, go to my office. You know, you're already late. Okay, so you got to go in there. He's got to give you a permission slip. He'd make you go in there, sit and wonder when he's coming. But he'd make his rounds just to be sure. When he went down the hall, the classes were in order, the whole thing. He was very rigid, very strict, but very fair. And his thing was to make us understand, I am here for you. I'm trying to get you ready to face this world that you're going out there into. And it's not a fair world. You will not find equality when you go out there. But you go out there, and we're going to give you the best tools you can take with you. Get out there and fight for your spot in the world. And that was one of the things that he wanted to do for us. I respected him because of that. And he was very stern, and he would say, doggone it, in a minute. You know, not curse, but he'd say, doggone it. And the way he said it, he would have said four or five expletives in that one doggone it. And he had long fingers. He played piano, too. In fact, he wrote our alma mater. Dear William Penn, Mr. Burford wrote those words to that song. He wrote that song. And he was the music person for First Baptist Church up here, the one that's on the historic register. That was his church. And he played. And he was just determined his kids were going to be the best kids ever. And he would accept no less than your best. You couldn't come to him half-stepping. And he knew better and would send you to his office in a minute and make you sit there and wonder, oh, Lord, is my mama going to show up first, or my daddy, or Mr. Burford? And when he came, you wanted somebody else. You didn't want him. They did. My brother stayed in trouble with him a lot, my older brother. But I didn't have any problem with him because I always knew he wanted what was best for us. He had a son. He has a son. His son lives in Greensboro. And I told Inman, you need to be over there too, treading on your daddy's legacy. What is up with you? He came for the 2010 or 11 Messiah that was here. And I was so happy to see him. I said, see, if I'd known you were here, I would have made sure they announced that you were in the house. Because a lot of people don't know his son. Only child he has. They had a daughter who died in almost infancy. So Inman has been the pride and joy. And he taught at A&T. He taught at Winston-Salem State. But he's now, I think, retired. But he is in Greensboro and can be contacted. I don't know what you can get from him, but I think I can get you a number to reach him if you want to reach out to him too and see if he'll come talk to you. But Mr. Burford was Mr. Burford every time you saw him, day or night. Burford, back then we had what we call... If you cut school, you're playing hooky and stuff, we had these officers that would go out in the community. And one of our teachers' husband was one of those, Mr. Bostick. And he would go, oh, gosh, there was a name. I'm trying to think of the name we called them. But they would go find you, if they could find you and bring you to school. Burford, somehow, you know, you try to keep things from teachers, but somehow they had their ways of finding out. You had some snitches. I have seen Burford in his little white with little gold fins on his little Plymouth herding about eight students up the street. He's driving behind him and them watching. He heard about the house party. All these folks going to cut school. He went to the party and drove along the street, herding them up the way. And what did the students have to do? Well, you had some washing walls up on ladders with the janitor. You had some down in the cafeteria. You had some working with the maid mopping and dusting things. That was the way he punished. He wasn't going to send you home. No. Huh. And we didn't have what was called in-school suspension. You worked it off. And you didn't do it just one day. It depends on what the infraction was. But he had his ways of doing it. He ran the school. Did you ever see the movie Lean on Me?
Yes.
Freeman? They could have been cut. He did not lock the doors with the chains. He didn't do that. But he ran the school. And he did command a lot of respect. And for the most part, I dare say he got it. But he respected the students, too. But if you were wrong, oh, he's going to be all up in you. You would be. But if you were doing something right, he'd give you those accolades, too. So I had a great relationship with him. I didn't have any problem with him. I mean, he had out a cousin, one of his cousins in my class, was scared death of him. I was never scared of him. Mm-hmm. Never one time was I afraid of him. I could talk to him. He fussed a lot, but he got your attention, and he just wanted you to know you're throwing away your life. You're wasting your life and wasting your time. Why are you here if you don't want to learn, you know? And he tried to make you look at yourself, do some introspection. I loved the man. I really did. He was another one I would visit when I'd come home, always. The last time I saw him, he had just retired, and he was wearing an African dashiki out there pruning his flowers in the yard when I drove up. I called and said I wanted to come by and brought my family. And he stopped, and I'd never seen him so relaxed. He was always so keyed up because he caught the Dickens from the superintendent. In many ways, I've seen him be disrespectful, the superintendent, to him. Burford standing at the door, the superintendent is coming. He holds the door open for him. He walks in, and there's a student in the hall, and Burford is saying to him, "Why are you out of class?" And he is talking to Burford over his shoulder as he's continuing to walk down the hall. Doesn't even respect that he just walked into this man's house. I don't care if you are the superintendent, this is still his school. And the student is saying that he needed to go. So, and he said, "Does your teacher know that you're out?" He said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Do you have a note?" And he said, "Okay, fine." He's trying to take care of business as well as, you know, get to the office to see this man. This man comes to his office. Now, I'm working in the offices, period. He walks in the office and goes behind his desk and sits down.
He sits
in Burford's chair. I was so mad. And I thought, and his secretary, Miss Leek, said, "Miss, come here, Andrews. I want you to take this note to Miss Hughes." She didn't want me to go anywhere. She just wanted me out of the way because I guess she thought I wasn't going to say anything probably because I didn't think Mr. Burford would have liked it. And so he just stood for a few minutes and stuff. The guy still didn't move. I came back in record time. I just wanted to see. And so when he got up to come out, I was trying to go in. He was trying to come out. I kept going. I didn't care. He had disrespected my principal. And first of all, I'm a female. So I went on through it was a little swinging door. Sure did. But he suffered more than a lot of people know because he was the one that was supposed to be the one that told everything that was going on in the neighborhood. And he wouldn't play that game. He also was the first African-American on the city council, if I'm not mistaken. I'm pretty sure I'm right about that. He was also one of the first ones on the Human Relations Commission when the gates of segregation started to fall here in 1968 when they created that. So Burford has had, this is but a minuscule amount of awards and plaques and things that he had in his house that I saw when I used to go visit. And I just wish you could know. He was an alpha. But he was a very religious man. You know, I didn't get a lot of his personal stuff. I just knew what I saw growing up. And that's what, you know, I still maintain. You treat people the way they treat you, if you can. And you don't take what people say about people. Find out for yourself. And I found out just in talking to him, this man was not. They thought he was the devil in disguise. People would have you think he had horns. He was not. He was not that way. But he had to, he said he had to have a certain persona to deal with certain students. He said, because if I didn't, they'd walk all over me. And he was right. He was right. Some of those very ones ended up in prison. And he was trying to save them from themselves, and he didn't want to give up on them. Ultimately, he had to. But this school, had it not been William Penn, should have been named Samuel E. Burton. The auditorium's named for him. That's not enough. That's not enough.
And he was principal here for a fairly long time, right?
When it was still, oh, what is that? There's some earlier pictures of the school. There were three buildings, I think, at one time. It was High Point Normal and Industrial. My father went here when it was that.
Right.
Then
normal
he went
school, right.
To 10th grade, yeah, because he went to Leonard Street and then he came over here. That was, gosh, my dad died at 80 in 2000. I'm trying to think. That's Bruford with his wife, Pearl, at this thingy right here. Looks like an award thing on the end right there. And I haven't seen too many pictures of them together. She was very quiet. Just trying to see where that picture is. I was looking at it today. It must be over here. But he is one of the long, he's the longest principal. I think that's a picture of him standing at the end of the hall. Oh, and those are our lockers on the hall there. That was second floor. Looking back down toward Griffin School, but it's got three buildings because they were wooden buildings initially. Maybe it's in that one.
Looks like he was also principal at Andrews for a little while.
He was, and that is another story. There was a guy hired out of Virginia when the school closed here in 68. And they hired a white guy out of Virginia to come in the fall. Didn't give him a shot. They went to court. Chess filed a grievance, and then he went through all the legal ramifications that he needed to, and Burford got the position. So that meant they probably had to buy the guy who already been given the job, but they weren't even going to give him a chance. And the people rose up and decided, that ain't happening. And it didn't happen. They have a bust of him over there now, which I love. And there were some other things that they had left over here. And I said, oh, no, that needs to follow him. And so he did get ensconced in that. Mr. Bell had issues when he went over there. The music was not what the white community wanted. And so they had a chance, to, I think it was, to go to Germany. They would not help raise the money to go to Germany, so they lost that opportunity. And I said to him later, if you'd ask every one of your students to send you $100 or less than that, your band could have gone. He said, but, you know, it just was so overwhelmingly sad that the community could not see the exposure that the kids would have gotten. And the fact that we were asked to come to Germany. I said, well, you know, ignorance is everywhere, you know, but don't ever do that again. For your band, because we know what kind of teacher you are and were, we would do anything to help support. But his going was in question, too. I said, these are the two most powerful guys for us at this school, and then you're going to negate all of that to go to, and I tell Andrews, I said, you know, excuse me, but your daddy and your mom and dad are William Penn. Don't forget that. Okay. So when we brought you what we had, okay, the legacy continued because Burford was there, because Bell was there. Some of the other teachers went, but some of the others went other places. But those two men were there. So I'm very happy that they did get there. And I like to tell Mr. Wiles, too, I said, don't forget now who y'all daddy belonged, who we was, you know. I like to kid them about that. Because I tell them also, I said, and Mr. Wiles didn't know me that well at the time, I said, you know, the school was named for my father. And he looked at them, he said, you didn't misplace me. I said, Andrews is my maiden name. And it is. But I was kidding him about that. But my brother did escort the first homecoming queen. So, you know, I said, there's a little bit of us in there. Because he finished here in 66. But the young lady he escorted is, she's in a nursing home now. But she went on to become an attorney. And he escorted her for that first homecoming there. So,
I think Savannah has a question.
Okay.
She wants to ask.
Do you wish you could have told Mr. Bell or Mr. Burford anything before either of them died?
Probably how much I really appreciated knowing them, being involved with them, and having them in my life. They knew I cared about them. But if I could do anything, I would reiterate that. If I had just a chance to tell them one more time and just give them a hug again. Because I did give them hugs. I did. I am a hugger by nature. But like I said, they always thought Burford was old Ironsides or stone wall or something, that he was just rich. He wasn't really. He really wasn't. But he said, I had to put that on because there were so many people, even in our community, picking him apart. You're being partial to my kid and yada, yada, yada. You know, you let this one do that. But he tried to be fair. He really tried to be fair. I have to give him that. And I got no breaks, you know. It was like, okay, Andrews, what's going on with you? And he'd stop you anywhere. He'd see you in the street. What are you doing? Okay. And if he saw you, if I came home for a visit and hadn't gotten to his house before I saw him, what are you doing down there? You get ready to be the best nurse in the world. Well, no, but he said, why? You know, just like that. But he knew I'd give it my all. I was known to follow through and try to do my best, but I learned a lot of that from being here at William Penn. Most of the teachers cared. And some would say, we've got to make sure you get more than 100%. Because it's going to take 150 to 200% for you to get out there and compete. And most of them felt that way. So in many ways, I think we were really disenfranchised by integration. I had the full black experience. I'm very happy about that because of how rich it was. Yet I would go to nursing school and go into a segregated situation. Because the hospital school of nursing I went to, and that was the third largest hospital in the country at the time with over 1,080 beds. A and B side was the white side, C and D side was the black side. You got great medical care, and we got the best training I could ever have wished for. But a black nurse left $1 million to build a dorm for black students in her will. And when they built Armstrong Hall, we got to enjoy that. It was the best building on the campus. The white students could not live in there until the school, the whole hospital broke down the barriers. And that's when they were able to integrate the building. And they integrated the nursing school too. We had pink dresses, white pinafores and aprons, four pleats in our caps. The white students had blue dresses, white aprons, and pinafores, and 13 thin and long pleats and neckcap. They took the caps and put our band on, no, their band on, our pleats on. They made it a baby powder blue dress, but they had the same pinafore and apron, and they changed the pin. And once they did all that, then they could integrate him. But it took a black woman and her money to make that happen.
Money and make a
even
lot
in Atlanta,
happen.
Yeah. Even in, that's the only way they could get that building. This was for the building and the furniture. Everything was brand new. And when I went there, it was 3 years old. It was 3 years old. And it took them a little while to get it, but they did. They finally let that go. And, you know, we had clinics for both races on both sides of the hospital. Emory University folks trained there. We all had adequate staffing, medical staffing and all that. But you had black student nurses over here, white student nurses over there, and they didn't cross over until the last year. I came out in 65. They were starting then to cross over. And I didn't want to go, but my first job in 66 was on, had been formerly a white OB unit, and I was a well baby nurse. I was charge nurse in the evenings in a nursery. And by that time, it was mixing up. Because on our side, you could have 15, 20 births, one shift. Over there, you have two, three births, and the nurses chasing the doctors, trying to find a husband. And a lot of them will tell you, I came to nursing school to get a husband. Okay, that's fine. But we learned so much, so much from that experience. Wasn't easy. A lot of study, but we learned how to do the study group thing. We cried a lot together because I'd never left home to go anywhere that long. Georgia and I said, oh, my God, they killed black folks down here. And it was nerve-wracking. Traveling by train, it was just nerve-wracking. I wouldn't get off. Actually, I didn't have a lot of time because we usually went down at night, and you still have these two trains a day from Atlanta. But they stopped everywhere, Toccoa, Georgia, Spartanburg, Greenville, oh, you know, all those little places. And we had nurses getting on, nursing students getting on all the way down from Greensboro all the way to Atlanta. So we played pinochle a lot once we got to know each other. And, yeah, that kind of, you find your way to get around things. You do. Or you can let it eat you up. You find a way to fight it, but you don't have to always constantly be punching at it. If you go back in there and let your brain take over, sometimes you can do things. You can work smarter, not harder, in other words. So.
Well, Ms. Blayton, I tell you what, we appreciate you in this interview. And honestly, I know that there's a whole wealth more things that can be shared. And who knows, when we go back to the drawing board, then we might see about getting a second interview with you.
Okay. Because I didn't touch on that for Hughes.
Right.
The dean of women or dean of students, period.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, but whatever, let me know.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
I can do anything to help.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Take care.
Yep.